The Guardian. Everyone has their morning ritual. I shower, brush my teeth, and then I take a couple of vitamin tablets. The one I take most days is calcium, and that's because I don't. And then every now and then I do take a multivitamin with iron. 50% of my vitamin A, 100% of vitamin D, vitamin E, K, C, vitamin T, B1, B2, and iron, all 100%. Biotin. And I wouldn't normally take this day to day, but I have actually got a vitamin C and zinc tablet here. As you may be able to hear, I'm sounding a little bit coldy. And bottoms up. I know I'm not alone in my pill-popping habit. According to the market research firm Mintel, just under half of all adults in the UK take a vitamin or supplement every single day. And this year, the UK government will consider whether to fortify our flour with another type of vitamin, folic acid. Why? Because it has potential to reduce the risk of fetal abnormalities.
What happens is that your risk of your child getting a neurotube defect like spina bifida is very, very high.
I'm Greg Jackson, and on Science Weekly, we're discussing our love of vitamins and whether we should be fortifying our flour with folic acid.
My name is Salem Al-Gailani. I'm a research associate at the Department of History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Cambridge. I'm a historian of medicine, focusing on the history of vitamins.
Well, you're the perfect person to talk to because that's what we're really hoping to focus on today on Science Weekly. Can I just start by asking you, though, what is a vitamin? I feel like I know what it is. It's a little pill that comes in a plastic tub and I take them every day, but I don't actually have a sense of what one is.
Well, it's important to distinguish between a vitamin and a vitamin supplement. So we know vitamins as they come in health food shops and in supermarkets as pills, as supplements that we can take. But of course, vitamins are compounds, molecules that are present in all foods, or at least in many foods.
We haven't always known about vitamins and their importance to our health, though. Salim tells me that they didn't begin to appear on scientists' radar until the 1900s.
Well, so it's important to think about how nutrition was imagined at the start of the 20th century. So around 1900, diet and nutrition was generally understood in terms of quantity rather than quality. So the body was imagined as a kind of motor or engine, and nutrition, the science of nutrition, was focused on calculating sort of fuel and energy requirements in terms of inputs and outputs. But at the beginning of the 20th century, it's discovered that quantity is not enough and that quality was also important. And biochemists discovered that foods contain what they termed accessory food factors that were important in maintaining health and life. So animal experiments showed that simply by feeding animals a diet of carbohydrates, proteins, fats, minerals alone, that wasn't enough. And certain extra elements in the food, these so-called accessory food factors, were also required.
Accessory food factors. It's not as quite a catchy name, is it?
It's not very catchy. No.
So you mentioned that we did some studies in some animals and we realised that there was this other component of food that was really important. It wasn't just about consuming lots of calories. There was something about food that made it specific. Did we see that in humans as well?
Certainly an awareness increasingly over the early 20th century. So it's important to remember that around 1900, it's bacteriology that's really the prestige science. So it's largely assumed that all diseases can be caused by some kind of microbe. But there's an increasing awareness in the early 20th century that some diseases weren't caused by microbes, that framework wasn't enough to explain all diseases. I mean, these are deficient diseases like rickets, beriberi, and scurvy.
Something like scurvy is a lack of vitamin C, a vitamin C deficiency.
Absolutely, that's right. So increasingly, scientists begin to think of new ways in order to conceptualize disease, and these accessory food factors or vitamins, I thought, to be a really important element in that.
Fast forward to the Second World War, and the UK government introduced mandatory fortification of foods with vitamins and minerals. They did so to make sure that soldiers, as well as those supporting the home front, were fit and healthy.
So during the war, it's flour in particular, which is fortified with calcium, and also margarine with vitamins D and A, to make sure that the military, the health of the men on the front, and also the diet of the civilian population at home was provided with adequate and healthy food.
Were there any ill effects on people who were eating lots of these things?
So in the 1950s, there's increasing concern with a condition called hypercalcemia. So a number of cases of children especially who are found to have high calcium content in their blood, which was observed to have caused a certain range of potentially dangerous symptoms, ranging from irritability and loss of appetite to convulsions and other neurological conditions. So there's an awareness in the 1950s that too much fortification was potentially dangerous.
Wow. So not only are vitamins vital for life, but at the extreme end of the scale, they actually can be harmful.
Absolutely. So there's a real sort of difference in opinion, and a large number of doctors, clinicians, public health officials do regard over-supplementation or over-vitaminization, they call it, as potentially a very dangerous thing. And that does turn a lot of the public health community against fortification for a large proportion of the post-war period.
But despite this pushback, vitamins began to be introduced back into foods.
Come on, Bernie. Time for breakfast.
Tony Tiger said.
As our meals became more processed, vitamins were increasingly being stripped out of our food. So companies refortified their food with vitamins after it had been processed. This wasn't the only factor that led vitamins to becoming as ubiquitous as they are today.
Well, I think that there are lots of things going on here. And I think it's important to remember that vitamins mean different things at different times to different people. I think across the 20th century, vitamins have been in many ways symbols of a new nutritional knowledge of the benefits of science available to all. I think especially since the 60s and 70s, there have been widespread concerns about the healthiness of our everyday diets and our food supplies. So vitamins are widely taken as a kind of nutritional insurance to help improve our general health. And there's also been, I think, especially since the 70s, perhaps a growth in vitamin consumption that has gone hand in hand with a wider dissatisfaction with mainstream medicine and health services. So if we think that the NHS, for instance, isn't giving us all we need, then there's an increasing turn to things like vitamin supplements to help give our general health a particular boost.
That's fascinating. I never thought about it like that.
And also, I guess the other issue is that, especially since the 70s, there's been an increasing emphasis on individual responsibility for health.
So according to Salim, the rising rates of vitamin consumption is in part because of the concerns we have about both our diets and the healthcare system, meaning that the onus is on us to be fighting fit, not the government. But today, the government could be stepping back in and taking control. They're soon to discuss whether they will be fortifying flour with folic acid, a type of B vitamin. After the break, we'll be looking at this proposal in more detail.
And the last nutrition and dietary survey in the UK showed that 91% of women had less folic acid than the recommended threshold.
We'll be back in a minute.
The Voice Lab from The Guardian.
Hey, do you ever want a quick catch-up on the news headlines first thing in the morning while you're making breakfast or getting dressed? Well, if you have a Google Assistant or Google Home, we can help with that. The Guardian Briefing is an experiment from the Voice Lab, which in under 2 minutes brings you up to speed with what you need to know about the day's top stories. We'll make sure you don't miss a thing. To listen at any time, just say, Hey Google, speak to the Guardian briefing.
Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Greer Jackson. Before the break, we heard about the history of vitamins and specifically our relationship with them. We heard how, during the Second World War, the UK government mandated the fortification of things like margarine and bread. But now, we're going to move from the past to our present and possible future, because in 2018, the UK government announced plans to consider the mandatory fortification of flour with folic acid. So, what's the thinking behind this? That's what we're going to be talking about in the second half of Science Weekly.
My name is Linnea Patel, and I am a registered dietitian and sports nutritionist, and I am also a British Dietetic Association spokesperson.
I called up Linnea to talk about folic acid, and she told me that folate is a type of B vitamin, and whereas folates can be found in nature, folic acid is the synthesised form. Now, according to a report by Public Health England, 91% of women of childbearing age in the UK displays worrying levels of circulating folic acid.
It's really important at the beginning of pregnancy and the first stages of pregnancy. So actually, the recommendations in the UK are that women who are thinking of getting pregnant need to be taking a daily supplement of 400 micrograms of folic acid while they're trying to become pregnant up until the 12th week of pregnancy.
What happens if you don't have enough folic acid during those early stages of pregnancy?
What happens is that your risk of getting your child getting a neurotube defect like a spina bifida is very, very high. And then that comes with obviously profound disability issues in the long term.
Okay, so it's quite serious then.
It's very serious.
Spina bifida is when a baby's spinal cord doesn't develop properly in the womb. It causes a gap in the spine, which can lead to weakness or total paralysis of the legs. Although doctors don't exactly know why this happens, they do know that not having enough folic acid in the early stages of pregnancy can markedly increase the risk. One thing that did puzzle me, though, is why women are deficient. I asked Linnea where we can find this vital ingredient in our diets and why we aren't getting enough of it.
So folic acid, I always think in general with vitamins, a good source of vitamins are dark green leafy vegetables like spinach and broccoli. But folic acid can also be found in citrus fruits, in beans, in breads, in cereals, and rice and pasta. The reason why we're not getting enough is because our diets are not optimally balanced. And there's particular groups of women, especially those who come from poorer homes, who are not able to eat a lot of these foods. And they're the ones that are most susceptible to becoming deficient in folic acid.
The government is going to discuss this spring whether folic acid should be added or fortified in flour. What's your take on that? Do you think that's a good thing?
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is the call for fortification of flour with folic acid in the UK has been going on and on for many years. So there's already more than 80 countries in the world that have folic acid added to flour, but the UK has held off for a long period of time. So a recent study actually showed that if folic acid had been added to the flour since, for example, the 1990s, then more than 2,000 births of children who had neurotube defects would have been prevented simply by that simple intervention. So absolutely, the fact that now the government is seriously considering doing this is a move in the right direction that will help really bridge the gap for a population group that's really at risk and for something that can have a real profound and long-term effect.
So why has it taken so long? If it's already been done in 80 countries across the world and this is being an ongoing debate for what, 20 years or more? Why has it taken so long to be even discussed in government?
Yeah, because I think there's been other pressing issues, but I think also in terms of adoption of public health interventions, the UK are just known to be a bit more cautious. This is exactly the same with the vitamin D scenario, where lots of other countries were saying, actually, everybody needs to be taking a vitamin D supplement in the winter. But we adopted that quite late. And I think it's very much the same with folic acid.
Mm. Okay, and are there any risks to be adding folic acid to flour if people are already getting lots of it in their diet day to day? Are they going to then be overdosing if they have it, say, in the flour in their bread or the flour in their pasta?
No, because fortification of flour with folic acid is only a safety net. It doesn't mean that actually women no longer need to take a supplement even, or it doesn't mean that people who are eating foods rich in folic acid are going to be overdosing on it. And remember, folic acid is a B vitamin, which is a water-soluble vitamin as well. So say you were eating lots of different folic acid foods and taking in cereals that were fortified with flour and taking in a supplement, then your body would still be able to excrete the folic acid out if you were one of those people.
So, as Linnea says, the chances of overdosing on folic acid are very unlikely. And that's largely because it's water soluble, so you excrete it easily. But this is not true of all vitamins. Some can accumulate in your fat.
So you have two types of different vitamins. You have fat-soluble vitamins like vitamin A, vitamin D, vitamin K, and then you have water-soluble vitamins like vitamin C and B vitamins.
What's the distinction there between fat-soluble and water-soluble? Does that make a difference as to how much intake, I suppose, we can have? That's not quite the right phrasing, but I think you know what I'm getting at.
Yeah. So a fat-soluble vitamin just basically means that this type of vitamin, like, for example, vitamin A, needs to have fat around it to be absorbed by the body. It also means that it gets stored in fat. So what happens is your body can't excrete it. So this is why for something like vitamin A, it's important that you're eating enough of it, but then you don't go and take a supplement that's very high dose, because if you do, your body just has no way of getting rid of it. So it starts accumulating in organs like the liver, and over a period of time, that can actually cause liver toxicity.
So taking too many of these fat-soluble vitamins could be harmful for us.
Yes, and that will come from taking high-dose supplements.
To me, it seems like a no-brainer. Fortifying flour is cheap. It wouldn't change the taste of our cakes and bread. Plus, the evidence suggests there's no risk on overdosing on this vitamin. One widely heralded study even concluded that there was no need for an upper limit on folic acid intake. However, it's important to highlight that the arguments against fortification of flour do still remain. They largely focus on concerns around civil liberties being threatened by the so-called nanny state. These objections are mostly political, though, not scientific. I did have one final question for Linnea, and that was about my own pill-popping habit. Throughout this podcast, I've been repeatedly reminded of how important vitamins are for our health and the repercussions of not getting enough of this stuff. But also, on the other hand, that getting too much can be dangerous. So should we be taking them, yes or no?
Now, whether or not people should be popping a vitamin pill is not a straightforward yes or no answer, because it depends on an individual's circumstances. But in general, being a dietitian, I'm all about food first. So a supplement is very much that, a supplement. So a supplement can never replace a good diet. But I definitely think that there is a place for supplements in a diet if you take the right ones in the right quantities.
You said it's not a yes or no answer, but I'm wondering, are there particular groups who should be thinking about this more than others?
Definitely. There are definitely groups of people who need to be thinking about taking a supplement more as a nutritional safety net. So, for example, women who are planning to have a baby or who are pregnant or breastfeeding, children or teenagers with very irregular eating habits. People over 50, for example, also, because your absorption of certain nutrients starts to decline if you are a vegetarian or a vegan, obviously that limits certain food groups. You might be at risk of getting deficiencies, or dieters or people avoiding certain food groups may be deficient in key nutrients as well. And then obviously people who have eating disorders or medical conditions that are known to have absorption problems might need to think of a supplement as well.
Many thanks to our guests this week. If you've got a comment, thought, question about anything you've heard about today, please do get in touch. We love hearing from you. The email is scienceweekly@theguardian.com. This week's podcast was produced and presented by me, Greg Jackson, and until next time, goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.